Not hearing it. Hello again, and hello to those of you that joined us after the first couple of minutes. I'm glad to be with you, and I want to talk for a bit about our Parsha and one aspect of it. So the Parsha is called Vayechi, and you can hear the word chai or l'chaim in the middle of it. And so you would think that it's about living. Actually, the Parsha is about the death of Jacob. And then we'll see the word Vayechi in the last few verses of the Parsha, where it talks about the death of Joseph. So if we go to the beginning of the Parsha, it says Vayechi Yaakov, that Jacob lived, and then it starts to talk about the fact that he was coming towards the end of his life, the end of his days. And when I was studying to be a chaplain, one of the things that one of my teachers shared is that this death of Yaakov is understood by many to be what could be called a good death. Yaakov had the chance to talk to Joseph and then to all his sons, to all the brothers. And he had a chance to express his most important wishes for his death and burial and what he hoped for the future. And then he gave what in our tradition is are called blessings to each son. If you read the texts, which I'm not going to do now, they don't necessarily sound like blessings. In the usual way that we would use the word, they sound more like tough love and an honest parent's response to who their kid has been during his, because they were all boys, his life. And some of it was pretty raw and pretty truthful. But the rabbis over the years have seen lessons and tenderness in the words, despite the frankness. So I encourage you to look for that if you read through those blessings on your own. So one of the things Jacob did when he realized that he was at the end of his life is he called Joseph into him and asked Joseph to bring his bones back to the land of Canaan to be buried with his ancestors. He not only asked him, he required Joseph to make a pledge. And without going into the intricacies, Joseph placed his hand under one of Jacob's thighs and promised that he would fulfill that request. And then you hear the verse, Be'asof raglav al hamita vayigva v'ya'asaf el amav, that Joseph's legs were gathered into the bed, and then he expired and he was gathered to his ancestors. So a question that could come up is there's a lot of gathering the legs together and being gathered to ancestors. I'm just putting that out there. I'm not going to try to answer it right now. But the question for me, so what happened, sorry, is that once Joseph died, once Jacob died, Joseph went to Pharaoh and he said, you know, my father implored me to do this. I promised him, let me go up to Canaan and bury him. And Pharaoh gave him permission, and there was actually a whole Egyptian entourage, as well as all of Jacob's family, except for the little ones who, and they left the sheep and cattle behind. It doesn't say they left the women behind. My guess is they did because the children were left behind, but usually it says the children and women, and it didn't this time. And they go up and they have a big mourning ceremony there. They stay there and then they come back to Egypt. So one of my questions is, what is the power of granting people their last wishes? Why is it why does it have such a strong hold on us? In Jacob's case, we could understand that he wanted to be buried with his ancestors. But as we'll see at the end of the parsha, Joseph also asked for that. And Joseph was this, big viceroy in Egypt. He had lived all of his life in Egypt since he was a young man. And he was actually put in a coffin and he was embalmed. Jacob, on the other hand, because they were going to take him immediately up to Canaan, he was not embalmed. He didn't have any of the Egyptian funeral rites done. But both of them had this last wish to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. And the rabbis offer a lot of different reasons. They're not all, well, of course, he wanted to be buried in the place where his ancestor were buried, or he wanted to be buried in Israel. They were, particularly for Joseph, one of the rabbinic interpretations is, if I stay in Egypt, they could make me into an idol. They could build a statue of me, or they could make a big to-do of my tomb, and I don't want to be an object of idolatry. Another interesting interpretation was that when redemption would come and Mashiach would come, that it's the souls or the bones of people that were in Eretz Yisrael that would be that would rise again. And so there was an idea that all these tunnels in Egypt, because there had been so many Jews in Egypt, and we imagine that many of them would have died in all that time, that they had to build all these tunnels. I mean, this is, now that I'm saying it, it's very ironic given today's world, but there's this rabbinic idea that they had to build all these tunnels under Egypt and under the Nile so that the Jews could get their bones, they could roll back to Israel. I don't know how they would roll since Israel's supposed to be higher up. It's an aliyah, but there was an idea that they would go through these tunnels to make sure that they were in Eretz Yisrael. And one last idea was that there somehow there was an awareness of the 10 plagues that would come. And so the idea that if you were buried in Egypt, there would be lice in your grave, was also a reason not to be buried in Israel. So it wasn't always these nice romantic ideas. But I was just thinking about the power of honoring people's wishes in our lives, in our world today. Whether it's, having a will from somebody, a parent, or somebody that you're helping, and that there's a piece written into the will, let's say, or just a wish that's expressed that could be hurtful to somebody, or that doesn't seem like a very good idea to have somebody in charge of X, or to distribute. I don't even want to go into the details because this could be a sore point for some of you, and I don't want to. It is in my, it has been in my family, so I don't want to kick up any of that. But the idea that in spite of those things, in spite of it might not be the best idea, at least for many people, there's a tension between, well, they're dead now, so they're not going to know if we followed their wishes, and it doesn't make sense, or it's not fair, or it's just impossible, versus this was their last wish, and we have to find a way to honor it to the extent that we can. So that's just a question that I wanted to raise. Then I wanted to talk about another piece of the Parsha, and the connection between these two pieces is this idea that I mentioned at the beginning of ne'emaniyut, which is a form of the word trustworthy. So that if you are ne'eman, you are loyal, faithful, and it doesn't always mean having faith. It means that you are worthy of me having faith in you. You are trustworthy. You're reliable. That you're ne'eman. It's also a quality we attribute to God. So in this idea of carrying out the last wishes of someone, there is this element of trusting that this person is going to carry through on these wishes. Because once you're gone, you don't know what will happen. So the second place where it came up for me is that once the family had taken Jacob's bones back to Canaan and buried them, and then they came back to Egypt because Joseph was still a big mahaf there. The brothers started to wonder if now that Jacob was gone, now that the father who stabilized supposedly the situation, even though he had aggravated it a lot in the beginning, that now Joseph would really take revenge on them. And, might take advantage of them, etc. And so they went to Joseph and they said, please forgive us. They bowed down to him. They bowed down to the ground. Don't hurt us. And his answer was, Al tira'u ki tacha Elohim ani. Don't fear, because am I in God's place? It's up to God. I may be high up in the government in Egypt, but I'm not God, and this is God's work to figure out how to respond to you in the long run. And he then said, "You thought it was for evil to send me to Egypt, and God thought it was for good." And because I got here, I was able to save a lot of people from starvation, etc. Excuse me. And don't worry, I will take care of you. And then it says the beautiful verse in chapter 50, verse 21, Vayinachem otam vayadaber al libam. And Joseph comforted them, and he spoke to their hearts. So, what does it mean to speak to someone's heart? How do we share that expression of I hear you and I have empathy for how vulnerable you must feel right now, how scared of me you might be, how worried you are that now that dad isn't around, the whole past is going to come tumbling back on you. And Rashi, a medieval Jewish commentator, said, you put yourself in their shoes. That's what Joseph did. And that you don't exploit vulnerability. You don't give a lecture. And you don't do something that just turns them away, dismisses them. And he chose his words so that the brothers would be able to take in his response and his comfort that he intended that it should be received. So somehow, Rashi says that Joseph was able to respond to them in a way that was comforting and felt like they'd been heard and that they were safe. And that's just an amazing quality to have. Think of, you know, I think of all the times that words tumble out of my mouth or other kinds of responses. Just the way that groups of people act and in response without listening and hearing and without taking into consideration the vulnerability of the other. So the Talmud says that what comes from the heart goes straight to the heart. So I wish it was as simple as that, but maybe it is as simple as that, and that sometimes when we think we're talking from our heart, we're actually also not totally trusting that if we make ourselves vulnerable, it won't come back in our face. Because that's, you know, that's what enables people to really speak heart to heart, is when there's enough trust and there's enough feeling of safety that they can really share in a very deep way. So one of Rabbi Bradley Artson says that Joseph's model is treating the deep sharings of the other's heart, the revelation that comes out in their words, because these brothers were revealing that they were terrified and perhaps, you know, in some senses regretted what they'd done, that revelation is a fragile treasure. A fragile treasure. So I just wanted to give you one other metaphor for trust, and that is from Mickey Young, Aleha HaShalom. She was an incredible teacher and educator in Philadelphia, who died too young. She said that trust is like floating in water, that if you think about it with your brain, water can't hold you up, and yet you can float in water. Somehow you have to trust the whole process, and even if you can't figure it out with your brain, you just sort of fall back into the water and let it hold you. And I know that for many people, hi Reggie, for many people that I've sat with towards the end of their life, they're scared, and their family members often will say, you know, I don't know what to do. Should I take care of them? What should I do? And one response that has been helpful is, there's nothing left to do. Just be and let yourself float back, almost like you're floating in the water, but just fall back into God's hands, however you understand that. And let God hold you, and let God do the work. Have ne'emaniyut, trustworthy sense that there is this comfort and this safety in the world. So I'll stop there, open it up to questions. I guess you can just, I can see all of you, so if you want to raise your hand, I can.